come in, Sam Ackerman from Tauranga.
Good morning. Yes, I know my place. I live after headlines. It's no problem by me. As a long-time journalist, I hate the concept of the headlines being put any further back than it needs to be. No problem.
Oh, Nicola, she's got to be back on at midday. She needs to go and get ready for the next slot. Now, what's going on? The ever-going, sort of everlasting saga that is the America's Cup, and, of course, where it's going to be held and all the commercial mechanics of it. What about the key sailors in it? What's the story and the conjecture around Blair Tuke and Peter Burling?
So the pair, as we know, are crucial members, crucial cogs, and the faces of Team New Zealand, and they have done it all already in their young careers when it comes to the America's Cup. They have won it overseas as a challenger, and they've defended it at home. So theoretically, legacies are built by, you know, bigger, more, better, faster. All that's great. But technically, if you want to look at tick box ticking, they don't necessarily need to do anything else in the America's Cup to be icons and champions and be held in high esteem there. They've confirmed that they haven't signed on yet full time for the next defence of the old mug. They really want to know a bit more clarity around the fundamentals of the event before they commit, is what they're suggesting. Now, there's some aspects around that, and that includes the nationality rule that'll be ironed out sometime next month. So knowing how many people from each country, you know, how many people from outside the country you represent, you're allowed to pick in the team. So that'll be a major factor in it. I imagine that Team New Zealand and those making the rules are now tightening that even tighter to make sure it is even less appealing. But we can't sit here and say, well, it's okay for Team New Zealand to want to take this offshore because they want to make the money, and then have an issue with the sailors wanting to do best by themselves to make money in their career as well. So if they get a ridiculous offer from overseas, are we going to give them the Russell Coutts treatment? Is that going to be the new future for this? So I think that Team New Zealand's decision to take this event overseas, most likely, with their defence of it, has really wiped away that conversation. And I'm interested to see how it goes, because I can't imagine that that Grant Dalton will cut his nose off to spite his face with this one. They are obviously incredible sailors, but they're also their high intellectual property, their knowledge of what goes on inside their team is massive, and they are darlings of the media world and the public in general. So it'd be a massive blow to lose these. And respectfully, Dean Barker, it's not even a fair comparison, the concept of him going offshore. It's really the Coutts example that was that rocked the crew so far. So it's hard to imagine them going ahead without them, and certainly even harder to imagine them on the other side of the team. I don't think it will come to that, but there's so many other things they can do. They've got their own ventures on the side it's barely the side. It's their business, what they choose to do with. They have plenty going on that they do not need the America's Cup in their life to be fulfilled and still at the top of the game. They've got a live ocean project that they really keep so much emphasis on. They're starting now with SailGP. But I imagine this will come together in the end. But it is a dicey situation to leave some Team New Zealand fans feeling a little uncomfortable, I'd imagine.
Now, the Olympics, of course, is introducing new sports in an attempt to extend its relevancy. The Commonwealth Games, of all things, looking at a big revamp as well. A couple of sports are being, you know, do not touch, but it's pretty much everything else up for consideration.
Yeah, you talk about relevancy. If it's the island of relevancy, the Commonwealth Games could be drowning if it doesn't get itself a bit of a life raft and get going soon, because it is a bit of a mission for the Commonwealth Games to be held in the esteem it was for many of us growing up these days. It is still a crucial event, though, in the calendar of so many athletes around the world, and New Zealanders are very high on that list as well. You think of sports like lawn bowls and squash. These are the events where they really are put in the highest public esteem within the country. Now, world championships, of course, are the world championships, and they are huge. But it's fair to say that the squash world championships aren't watched by as many New Zealanders as the Commonwealth Games are. So this is the moment where sponsors get validated, where names and legacies get built in front of a New Zealand audience. My first reaction was, oh, the Commonwealth Games has nothing if it doesn't have tradition. I mean, you're saying just swimming and just athletics, everything else can come and go. It's got major consequences, Catherine, on funding, because it is done so far in advance. Now, as you're going to build towards, you know, first of all, Commonwealth Games, then the Olympics, and for some sports, this being their marquee event. Now, the rug could be pulled on when you'll be involved next. You may win a gold medal at an event and your event doesn't come back into the Commonwealth Games for a cycle of the rest of your career. So there's going to be some massive ramifications for this. But the fact of the matter is they need to get people really interested in the regions, in the areas that the Commonwealth Games get hosted, because apparently getting countries to build and put together teams to bid for these events is becoming more and more difficult because it's, as I say, the relevancy is not there. You're taking on sports that aren't there for your region. So it means that if India was successful again, they could put Kabaddi in there, where it's just, you know, it will be a huge hit for the locals, but also seemingly guaranteed medals for the host as well, because, you know, while we have leagues here that will play it, it certainly won't be at the level of the home of the national sport. So there's some talk that New Zealand may be at a co-bid with Australia in the future, and I've already put my hands up to say we really need to get Manus off the wharf as one of the key sports to push there. I think New Zealand will be at a clean sweep both the male and female categories, perhaps gumboot throwing. We need to start thinking big there. But this will see potentially esports, Catherine, make its way into Commonwealth Games.
No, so they can have their own world championships. No,
it's going to get murky. It's going to get messy. But it will be of interest, and it will pique the interest and be part of conversations outside of the actual Commonwealth Games. Because respectfully to the Commonwealth Games, and I say this, it means a lot to me as a sport. My granddad was the groundsman of the 1950 Empire Games at Eden Park, and he spoke about it for the most of his life. It was such a crowning moment, so I've always had a soft spot for it. But the Commonwealth Games aren't spoken about outside of that Commonwealth Games window. We love it when it's there. It's like an avalanche of medals. It's great and it's joyful, but we don't hold on to this and build up to this as a country the way that we used to. So
it's going to affect the sports funding as well. And this is another complication that's going to come in as these sports broaden. And I'm grateful they are broadening. I think that's pivotal. But the problem then is the insecurity around traditional sports funding. And then how do you divvy up a pie when there are new kids on the block? And that age-old argument of how do you decide who gets what based on what?
Yep, and the sports that rely on this as a pinnacle event would be hugely nervous, massively nervous, because without this pinnacle event, that slice of funding becomes difficult. Ask basketball in this country. Of course, when they can get to the world champs, it's a massive deal, and no one will forget in 2002 what the wave we ran as a country of being so proud of what the Tall Blacks were achieving. But getting into their pinnacle event is extraordinarily difficult, and so therefore funding is as well. So it is a double-edged sword of there is some sports that'll be in a much better position because of it, but as I said, the funding model will be a really difficult one to uphold, and it'll make high-performance sport in New Zealand certainly have to be on their toes a lot more, and maybe even potentially reevaluate how that funding goes along the way. But look, you've got two choices when it comes to sports and sporting events: it's evolve or extinction. And Commonwealth Games is looking to get on the evolve bandwagon, which is probably the smartest move for them.
Just looking at league and a couple of events related really this week. The books that are co-written by sports people can fall into two categories: really insightful and engaging and interesting, or just a way did you pay for it? And sometimes, you know, is it worth the interview? Has the guest actually had any part in writing the book, and is the book revealing anything? There was a big one out this week with Sonny Bill Williams, co-written with Alan Duff.
Yeah, and first of all, an intriguing subject and a hell of a writer in Alan Duff. I mean, that's an amazing pairing. I mean, I'm looking at a wall of about 50, maybe 60, 70 sports biographies at the moment, Catherine, and I can tell you that Sonny Bill Williams, from everything I've read of it so far, will be one of the most interesting ones to go onto that shelf. I've followed Sonny Bill's career as a journalist right through, and I was among his most vocal and biggest detractors when he walked out on the Bulldogs. I thought it was a petulant and childish move, and the information that came out, and certainly his reactions at the time, I thought were completely unwarranted, the way he was referring to things at the time. Now, with the benefit of hindsight and with seeing the growth in Sonny Bill Williams, if you told me that I'd be sitting here back then, that I'd be sitting here singing his praises as a role model and what exactly he's managed to achieve with his life, I would have looked at you sideways at the very least, Catherine. But the thing that for me is I've read virtually everything about this man throughout his career. I have learnt maybe more about St. Bill Williams in the past week with the release of information and interviews like yours on the show than I did in the previous part of his career. He was always intriguing, but because there was such a demand, a thirst for Sonny Bill Williams and SBW Fever, he kept his cards close to his chest. You can understand why. He didn't want to make everything a public commodity, and after everything he went through in the early stages of his career and the womanizing, the boozing and the drugs, he wanted to make his life his life. But I've been really intrigued by how much he's given away of himself, how different it is across the spectrum. So the interview with you, super different than a really great interview with Toby Wall in the spin-off, for example. And everywhere he's gone, he's managed to make the conversation real and genuine. So I think that if you're a sports person or an aspiring sports person, I would say this book is probably going to be up there with maybe Andre Agassi's piece, which was a hugely open, was a massive book in that regard, where I think you kind of need to read it to really get a gauge of what it is. The way he pulled his life through to where it is now is phenomenal. He's really opening the curtains as well. So what did you make of speaking
to him? Look, I think the Alan Duff effect is part of this, because you can have a co-writer or a ghostwriter, and really it's just about getting books on the shelves for Christmas and getting some money flowing in, to be quite blunt. But Duff is different. In fact, it was the second book he co-wrote last week. Mark Van Leeuwen and The Undercover Cop was another one whose story he teased out. So he is genuinely wanting to get to the bottom of things, and I think people trust him, and I think Sonny Bill was also at the point where he was ready to be very honest with everyone about what made him, and the self-esteem revelations around his childhood and as a young man are intriguing and fascinating. The drivers that made him train so insanely and that forced him to compete in a way where he would best people. As he said, I was the skinny little, you know, white Samoan trying to prove I was a real Samoan. Those, they're not only revelatory, but they're actually really important for other young men
hugely
to see. And the other stuff he revealed about the breaking the contract, it cost him the thick end of $1 million. The state of mind he was in at the time, you learn a lot more in retrospect. But to be prepared to communicate that and to do it as well as he did, it is worth a lot.
Yeah, I agree entirely. And a lot of sports people have made mistakes, and they will give you an empty mea culpa. Whereas he, already when he came back to league, and there's a lot of thoughts he's playing for the Roosters, and he went out of his way to try to make things right with the Bulldogs fans. When I found that really intriguing, because he'd stayed so far away from it right throughout, and I thought that he would just kind of leave that is and say that's in the past, as most sports people do. But admitting that he could have done things better, and he still holds fond memories. He won everybody over everywhere he went. He was so controversial. Everybody got into a money bill, all that kind of jazz. There's still a few detractors, of course, but the professional he carried himself in has changed every club he's touched. Every club he's gone to has get it better because of Sonny Bill Williams, and that's a phenomenal asset to take. I'm not talking about on the field. The people within the team are better.
There's
because of him.
There's something else I'd observe just very quickly. I think we are getting better, and I think some of these sports are getting better at rehabilitating players, particularly in New Zealand. Young men who do some pretty stupid things and get absolute, you know, exposed for it in the media, I know they are investing more and helping with their problems, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but they're definitely investing more and doing more. And second, I can think of a few examples of that, and so can you. And second, I think we're getting more mature at letting them leave it in the past, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, for sure.
Very, very quickly, one more league legend to note.
Yeah, unfortunately, the sad news that Ray Cranch, who was the oldest living former Kiwi League international, has passed away at age of 98. He was he toured in 1951 and with the Kiwis. And look, before that, he'd already gone through and survived the World War, and that included fighting at Monte Cassino. And so he was a real giant of the game in the context of not what he achieved on the field, because he wasn't a big Kiwis international superstar, but his input into the game afterwards has been nothing short of phenomenal. He's a life member of the Auckland Rugby League, where he was the secretary and the manager and president, everything you can think of, a life member of the NZRL, and he's on the Queen's Honours list for his gifts to sport as well. I met him a few times. He was just a gentle, lovely man, and you'd see some of the biggest Kiwi names you can think of just go up and speak to this guy with nothing but adoration as well. So he is phenomenal. He was Kiwi 341, and they're up to now 8 23. So if it hadn't been for COVID wiping out a couple of seasons of Test footy, we're talking about there could have been 500 players to have represented New Zealand in the time that he did, that he was able to watch. That's phenomenal.
Thanks so much, Sam Ackerman.